So anyway, I'm Bhante Sujato and coming to you today from Harris Park, which is the land of the Burramadigal people of the Darug Nation. And for those of you who are coming from Australia, then you know that the voice referendum is tomorrow. So get out there and say yes. And if you're not Australian, then just go out there and say yes anyway, even if you don't get to vote, but still, why not? Doesn't hurt. And look, I feel like I need to say something today on the horrifying conflict that's emerged in Israel and the Gaza Strip in recent days. And even though I don't really want to sort of be coming here and talking about bad news, which you're probably hearing too much of already in your lives, but at the same time, we need to have some kind of Buddhist response to this. So first of all, my compassion for all of those who are suffering, all of those who've died, who've been injured, and for the lives of the innocent who have been hurt and are being hurt in the ongoing conflict. Let us never forget that it is those who least deserve it who suffer the most whenever there is wartime. The actions of Hamas in initiating the conflict are completely beyond the pale, and their brutality and violence has been horrifying to witness. It's important to remember that when considering these things, that our role or our job is to try and be adults and be, the Buddha said, to be peaceful among those who are violent. And remember this, and I want everybody here to just try to bear this in mind. Be a force of stability and compassion and wisdom. Don't get caught up in hate. Don't get caught up in sharing internet conspiracy theories. And don't get caught up in all of the nonsense which is going to be spewing through the ideosphere in the coming weeks, okay? And I just wanted to make a few points to try to help retain some clarity around this issue and similar issues. First point I want to make is that there is a difference between actions and circumstances. The actions of Hamas are the actions of Hamas. The actions of the Israeli government are the actions of the Israeli government. Of course, there are many circumstances that influence those actions, circumstances that go back a long time, and we can point the blame, probably should point the blame to those circumstances. But those circumstances do not excuse or explain the choices that people make in that situation. And yes, Hamas has suffered from a lot of oppression, the Gaza Strip has suffered from a lot of oppression and injustice for a long time. Absolutely true, but that does not in any way excuse their actions. So this is the first thing, is just to retain some clarity about this. Second thing that I would emphasize is just to, again, retain some clarity about who is who. Hamas is Hamas. They are not Palestine. They are not Palestinians. They are not Arabs. They are not Muslims. They are not anything else. They are Hamas. And so if we're talking about the actions of Hamas, keep their actions with them. Similarly, the actions of Netanyahu's government are the responsibility of Netanyahu's government. They're not the responsibility of the Jews or of the United States or of anybody else. So don't get caught up in like double thinking and conspiratorializing everything, okay? People are responsible for their actions. So this is another thing that I would like to try to bear in mind and to clarify. Third thing I'd like to bear in mind and to clarify is that not all international conflicts are the same, and not all of them are similar. Sometimes it's a fairly straightforward situation, like when Russia invaded Ukraine, it's the action of a genocidal psychopath who wanted to expand his empire. And there's one solution to that, which is that Russia withdraws its army and goes home. And that can be accomplished at any point by Putin simply picking up the phone and saying, come home. That's it. That's the solution. In the Middle East, there is no such simple solution. And people have been trying to sort out solutions for this for a long time. And it's very complicated. And I do not understand it at all. And I'm just going to make a confession here. When I was growing up, and like when I was like 18, 19, 20, so this was like in the mid-80s, the whole thing seems such, we studied this in history in high school, and the whole thing seems so convoluted, so messed up, that since then I just stopped reading about it. And so since like 1985, I haven't really followed any kind of news about this, except for some very basic kind of things. So I really don't understand much about it, but it is very complicated. And if you think that there's a simple and obvious solution to the problem, you might want to entertain the possibility that you're an idiot. I'm just saying it is a possibility, okay? That's one possible kind of option. I'm not saying you are. I'm just saying you might want to entertain that possibility. Okay. So, and the last thing I want to say is, you know, I think that at the moment that, you know, we should all be asking for restraint from the Israelis. We should be asking for moderation. We should be insisting on the observance of the rule of law. Wars have rules. They have had rules for a long time, actually. The purpose of rules in law, so of rules in wartime, is not just to protect one's enemy from atrocities. It's also to protect oneself from becoming brutalized and to retain one's own humanity, because the people who are doing these things will have to live when the war is over. And the peoples who are involved in this will have to find some way of reconciling and living together. This is why we have rules in wartime. So we need to insist on a high standard of not becoming as brutalized as the enemy is, no matter how bad the atrocities may be. And just one final point that I'm going to make, it's far too early to really be able to assess what's going on, but one thing that has become apparent right in the initial stages is how wrong everybody was about Hamas. And the general consensus in the international community was that Hamas were hardliners, yes, and they did a lot of bad things, yes, well, who hasn't done a lot of bad things? But they're pragmatic and you can deal with them. And that has been, that myth has been exploded in the last few days. The same process that we've seen playing out in the international sphere repeatedly. We've seen that with Vladimir Putin. People thought he was a hardliner that you could deal with until we saw the armies massing on Ukraine border. Same thing happened with the Taliban. And the same thing's happened with the modern Republican Party under Donald Trump. They're no longer a reasonable force of people who can be negotiated with and discussed in a good faith and rational way. And I think those of us who would like to belong to a world where conflict can be resolved through reason and compassion and empathy and talking, that's great, and we need to lift people up to that state, but we can't just assume that everybody is in that state, because it's just not true. Yeah. So I'll just leave you with that reflection for now. And again, I'm really sorry to sort of talk about such kind of traumatizing things, but I think it is necessary to provide at least a little bit of guidance. Like I said, I don't really have any answers for the problem, and I just hope that they find peace as soon as possible. Okay, now let's do some chanting of recollection of the virtues of the Triple Gem.
Yeti piso bhagavarahaṃ sammā sambuddho vijjācaraṇa sampanno sugato lokavidu anuttaro purisa dhamma sarathi Sattha deva manusanang buddho bhagavati svakato bhagavata dhammo sandhyatiko akaliko Ehi pasiko opanayiko pacatam veditabo vinyuhiti. Supatipanno bhagavato savaka sangho. Ujjupatipanno bhagavato savaka sangho. Nyayapatipanno bhagavato savaka sangho. Samichipatipanno bhagavato savaka sangho. Yadidam chattari purisa yugani artha purisa pungala esa bhagavato savaka sangho. Ahuneyo pahuneyo dakhineyo anjali karaniyo anutaram punyaketa lokasati.
Okay, very good. Thank you for that musical gift. So we're going to be doing some meditation now. So for today's meditation, we are going to be following along with the practice that I've been doing for this rains retreat. So for this few months of the rains retreat, I've mostly been doing talks on the suttas that I've been studying during the week and doing meditations that are in some way inspired by those suttas and by those teachings. So this week will be no exception. So today we are going to do a meditation on the five aggregates, the Panchupadana Khandha, which are, of course, form, feeling, perception,
choices,
and consciousness. Excellent, very good. Five of them. And why are there five? Because they're the pancha upadana khanda, the five. Because you grab hold of them and they punch you in the face. Okay? All right, and then you suffer. The Buddha's teaching is very profound. Yeah, it's very profound. It's very there are a lot of subtleties to it. So, yeah. Okay. All right, so we're going to do a short meditation on these five aggregates for today, and you know, we're just going to just lightly graze over the surface of this particular meditation. We're going to be focusing on essentially two stages in the meditation, which is firstly to recognize each of these five aggregates. Are we going to do that? We are. Are we? I think we are, yes. And we're going to reflect on them as impermanent. Okay? Now, sorry, the reason I'm having a bit of doubt here is I'm wondering whether we should restrict it to just some of the aggregates. I'm going to restrict it to just some of the aggregates, not all of them. We're going to do just feeling and rupa and vedana, form and feeling. Okay, for this meditation, just to keep it a bit more concrete and grounded for this very short meditation. So we're going to look at form and feeling, and we are going to see them as impermanent. All right? So that's for today's meditation. Let us begin. So, sitting quietly. Letting the mind settle down into the body. Just notice whatever feelings, emotions, moods that you're carrying in your body. Ah, it's okay. It's all right. Just feel how they are. Nothing to do about it. Nothing, no problem to solve. Just be aware. Okay, so now we can bring attention to the gentle feeling of the breath as it comes in and the breath as it goes out. And we are noticing the physical feeling of the breath. Just air. that stream of breath, subtle as it is, has an impact on your nostrils, on your throat, your lungs, and then ripples throughout your whole body. So you can feel that gentle, soothing rhythm of the breath through your whole body. Now when that sensation of the breath becomes soft and gentle, notice that inside that breath is also a feeling. It has a warm, soothing, pleasant feeling to it. It feels nice. Your breath is bringing you ease and comfort. Now, let's reflect on the impermanence of the breath and the impermanence of the feelings of the breath. Since we have started this meditation, each breath each of those breaths has gone, even during the breath the physical sensation changes, the rhythm of the breath has changed and altered as we've been sitting. A more rough, coarse breath at the start is now more subtle and refined. But the breath itself is dependent on the body and dependent on the mind. If we breathe out and don't breathe in, life ceases. The breath ceases. And so each breath is fragile, dependent, changing, tottering, falling over, becoming something else. Soon, this breath will be gone. Now, we feel this feeling. And since we've been meditating, the feelings in our mind and body have changed. Our mood has settled. We feel that sense of comfort and relaxation through the body. But that sense of comfort and relaxation itself is changing. Itself is conditioned. Itself is fragile. And if we hold these two things in our consciousness, the physical feeling of the breath, the pleasantness of the breath, both of them are streams of conditions, of energies that are constantly in flux. And when we look closely at them, we see change. So now we're coming to the end of the meditation. And we've just reflected back on the impermanence of the meditation. To recall how we are different now than how we were at the start of the meditation. How the sensation of the breath was then and how it is now. How the feelings were then and how the feelings are now. And finally, we can dedicate the merit of our practice. May all beings be happy, may all beings be well. May all beings find peace and safety. Okay, very good. Let us have a short break and come back for the Dhamma talk. So, welcome back, everyone. And g'day to folks online. And so let's just dive right into the Chula Sachaka Sutta. Most of you have been around for some of my classes before, but just for those who are new for this Rains Retreat, I've been doing some annotation and some study of Buddhist texts. And as I've been doing so, revising my translations. And one of the things that I'm finding when I'm doing that is that I'm just discovering all of these new things. Well, they're new to me anyway, and I feel kind of quite, it's kind of interesting. So I'm just trying to share some of these things in some of my talks. Anyway, let's talk about the Chula Sachaka Sutta. I'll begin by reading the opening passage of the sutta. So I have heard. On one time, the Buddha was staying near Vaisali in the great wood in the hall with a peaked roof. Now, at that time, Sachaka, the son of Jain parents, was staying in Vaisali. He was a debater and a clever speaker, deemed holy by many people. He was telling a crowd in Vaisali, "I don't see any ascetic or Brahmin who would not shake and rock and tremble, sweating from the armpits, were I to take them on in debate. Not a leader of an order or a community, or the teacher of a community, and not even one who claims to be a perfected one, a fully awakened Buddha. Even an insentient post would shake and rock and tremble were I to take it on in debate. How much more, then, a human being?" Then Venerable Asaji, robed up in the morning, taking his bowl and robe, entered Vaisali for alms. As Sachaka was going for a walk, he saw Asaji coming off in the distance. He approached him and exchanged greetings with him. When the greetings and polite conversation were over, Sachaka stood to one side and said to Asaji, "Master Asaji, how does the ascetic Gotama guide his disciples? And on what topics does instructions to his disciples generally proceed?" "Agivesana," replied Asaji, "this is how the ascetic Gotama guides his disciples, and his instructions to disciples generally proceed on these topics. Form, feeling, perception, choices, and consciousness are impermanent. Form, feeling, perceptions, choices, and consciousness are not self. All conditions are impermanent. All things are not self. This is how the ascetic Gotama guides his disciples and how his instruction to his disciples generally proceeds." "It is sad to hear, Master Asaji, that the ascetic Gotama has such a doctrine. Hopefully, sometime or other, I'll get to meet Master Gotama and we can have a discussion. And hopefully I can dissuade him from this harmful misconception." Now, at that time, around 500 Lichavis were sitting together in the town hall on some business. Then Sachaka went up to them and said, "Come forth, good Lichavis, come forth. Today, I'm going to have a discussion with the ascetic Gotama. If he stands by the position stated to me by one of his well-known disciples, a mendicant named Asaji, I'll take him on in debate and drag him to and fro and round about like a strong man would grab a long-fleeced sheep by its fleece and drag it to and fro and round about. Taking him on in debate, I'll drag him to and fro and round about like a strong brewer's worker would toss a large brewer's sieve into a deep lake, grab it by the corners and drag it to and fro and round about. Taking him on in debate, I'll shake him down and about and give him a beating like a strong brewer's mixer would grab a strainer by the corners and shake it down and about and give it a beating. I'll play a game of ear washing with the ascetic Gotama like their 60-year-old elephant would plunge into a deep lotus pond and play a game of ear washing. Come forth, good Lichavis, come forth. Today I am going to have a discussion with the ascetic Gotama." At that, some of the Lichavis said, "How can the ascetic Gotama refute Sachaka's doctrine when it is Sachaka who will refute Gotama's doctrine?" But some of the Lichavis said, "Who is Sachaka to refute the Buddha's doctrine when it is the Buddha who will refute Sachaka's doctrine?" Then Sachika, escorted by the 500 Lichavis, went to the hall with the peaked roof and the great wood. Now, at that time, several mendicants were walking mindfully in the open air. Sachika went up to them and said, "Good sirs, where is Master Gotama at present? For we want to see him. Agivesana, the Buddha has plunged deep into the great wood and is sitting at the root of a tree for the day's meditation." Then Sachika, together with a large group of Lichavis, went to see the Buddha in the great wood, exchanged greetings with him. When the greetings and polite conversation were over, he sat down to one side. Before sitting to one side, some of the Lichavis bowed, some exchanged greetings and polite conversation, some held up their joined palms towards the Buddha, some announced their name and clan, while some kept silent. Then Sachika said to the Buddha, "I'd like to ask Master Gotama about a certain point, if you'd take the time to answer." "Ask what you wish, Agivesana." All right, so there's the setup. Okay? Right, pretty dramatic. Okay, so let's go back and let's kind of go walk through some of these things and sort of figure out what's going on here. So first of all, let's just get some basics. Of course, we're in Vaisali, which, as we all know, is north of the Ganges, north of current-day Patna. Ganges was a republican federation, one of the most powerful states at the time of the Buddha. The Lichavis were the leading clan of the Vajjin Republic. So the Vajjin Federation was an alliance of different clans, but the Lichavis were the dominant clan. So these were kind of aristocratic and powerful people that Sachika was talking to. Now, who was Sachika? Well, his name means truthy. Okay, Sachika means truthy. Okay, and maybe it was just a kind of a name, but fair enough. He's said to be Nigantaputta, which is a curious kind of epithet. It's the only time that epithet actually appears in the suttas. Niganta is normally a word for a Jain ascetic, right? So specifically a Jain ascetic is called a Niganta. And the Jains came from that area, right? The founder of the Jains, Mahavira, was born nearby to Vaisali. So it's kind of their area. So what exactly is that? But from the text itself, and there seems to be quite a lot of confusion about this point, so different sources will tell you that he was himself a Jain or a Jain ascetic or something like this, but from this discourse and the next one, which also features Sachika, it's clear that he was neither a Jain nor was he a renunciate. He was a layperson who, according to the commentary, had Jain parents, hence he was known as Nigantaputta. So that seems to be reasonable. We know he's not a Jain because in the next sutta, Mahasachika Sutta, he actually takes on Mahavira, the leader of the Jains, in debate, just like he took on the Buddha. So it's not really the behavior as you expect from someone who's a Jain. So he was more of a kind of freelance controversialist, right? Who used to wander around the place, engaging with people because he liked a good argument, right? And I like to see him as being, if you will, a spiritual forebear of the troll. So Sachika pioneered a number of techniques that today we would attribute to internet trolls. For example, I was only asking questions. Lol, it was just a joke. But everybody else is saying it. And so maybe it might cause us to, I don't know, revise our assessment of modern internet trolls rather than thinking of them as brave, courageous, innovative truth tellers. Of course, that's how we think of them. Is that how we think of them now? Then maybe we realise that actually it was Sachika who was the pioneer who laid the groundwork for much of the modern trolldom empire. Anyway, so Sachika, Nigantaputta, fine. He features in two suttas, this one, Majjhima 35, and the next one, Majjhima 36, which I won't discuss today. It seems that Majjhima 36 was afterwards. All right, so one of the things that I've been doing in my research is looking for correlations and connections between what we find in the suttas and things what we find in especially the pre-Buddhist literature, Upanishads and Vedas and things like that. And in this particular case, there seems to be a variety of connections, some close, some tenuous, let's just say that right up front, with the teachings of a certain fellow called Uddalaka, who I'll be referring to throughout this session. Briefly, Uddalaka was the preceptor of the sage Yajnavalkya, who I referred to earlier, and he was the pioneer of some of the most famous ideas and sayings within the Brahmanical sphere, most famously the idea Tad Tvam Asi, thou art that. So this was Uddalaka who said this. Uddalaka's method was kind of interesting because he's been called one of the world's first naturalistic philosophers. He tended to work a lot from like observations of nature and drawing inferences from how nature works to establish his philosophy, which of course is something that the Buddha did a lot as well. And so there are some connections, some of them specific, some of them very vague, some of them probably just actually just tenuous speculation. I don't really know why or what the significance of that is. So I'm not really offering an interpretation for why there's this connection. Maybe Satchika was kind of a student of his. I don't know. Or maybe this was kind of like a response or reinterpretation of Uddalaka's doctrine. I really don't know what the significance of it is, but I'm just going to note a few points as we go that might help to illuminate that. Okay, so one of the basic reasons for seeing that similarity with the teaching of Uddalaka was because the most famous passage with Uddalaka Aruni was when he sent his son off to learn, and when his son Swetaketu came back, he was arrogant and prideful and full of himself. And he learnt all of this stuff but didn't have any understanding. And of course, it's already sounding quite a bit like Satchika. But also, it's a fairly general thing. I mean, he's not the only person to do that, right? But anyway, there's that. Yeah?
I'm just curious, is there any comment on how old this person is,
Satchika? Is there any thing on how old Satchika is? No, I hadn't thought of that. Good point. But no, I mean, he's kind of got a bit of a young energy, right? Right? Yeah, it seems like a bit, yeah, like sometimes it has that thing, like sometimes you hear the like some of the Brahmins are said to be like young students who are kind of really aggressive, and then maybe their teachers are a bit more understanding. So yeah, it's probably, he was probably quite a young guy. As you see, it seems to have a young energy anyway. So he goes, he makes this challenge, he's going to, all this stuff, great, it's really impressive. Then he meets Asaji. Okay, so of course Asaji is, as you well know, one of the five ascetics, very good, who was taught by the Buddha in Benares in the deer park, and who, according to tradition, became an arahant at that point. Now, we don't hear much from Asaji, or indeed any of the other five ascetics, much later on. I mean, it seems they probably lived a very quiet renunciate life from that point on. But we do hear one famous story of Asaji, which is when?
Sariputta.
Sariputta, yes. Sariputta met him similarly while he's going for alms round, right? And asked him about his questions. And so, and Asaji said to him, what was it he said again? What was Asaji's reply to Sariputta at that point? Thank you so very much. And just in case there's anyone here who doesn't know Pali.
I'll leave it for them.
In English?
Oh, you want me there?
Yeah, if you... anyone in English?
Maybe if you paraphrase. So everything that arises has a cause.
Sounds pretty good, right? So everything that Asaji taught Sariputta, everything that arises from a cause, their cause and their cessation, this is the teaching of the Mahasamana, of the Buddha. And that inspired Sariputta. He went and got his friend Mahamoggallana, and they came and they ordained. So this was that very famous, like that saying of Asaji's is one of the most famous and widespread of all Buddhist sayings. And it was that's among other things, that's the standard phrase which is inscribed in stupas and statues and monuments right throughout India for the whole period of Buddhism. So probably more than any other phrase of Buddhism is recorded in the archaeological evidence. Okay, Yeah.
From a time perspective, was it before the Kalama Sutta,
Yes, it's before Kalama Sutta. Who's to say? Yeah, go on. Yeah. Well, the question was: is this how is this relating in time to the Kalama Sutta? Probably can't really say. I don't think we've got any indications in either case. But I think in both cases, you know, they're probably quite a cosmopolitan sort of centre. There's probably a lot of teachers going through. Mm-hmm. Certainly, it was a big centre of the Jains, but also there was a big Brahmanical centre because Mithila, which was where Yajnavalkya was centred, is kind of just to the north. In fact, the Vajjin Republic basically took over from the Mithila Kingdom. Mm-hmm. Right, so there's that kind of a shared cultural area. Okay, anyway. Okay, so good. Now, so here we come to the first real problem of this sutta. How does the ascetic Gotama, and what topics does his teaching generally proceed? Okay. And Asaji says, well, he normally teaches form, feeling, choices, five aggregates are impermanent, the five aggregates are not self. The problem is that that's actually not how the Buddha normally teaches. Yeah. Normally he teaches the five aggregates are impermanent. There's one missing. What's missing? Dukkha, suffering. Okay, so suffering is missing and not self. Okay, very good. So it's actually a very unusual thing. Rather than saying this is what the Buddha normally teaches, in fact, it's not normally teaching. In fact, the Buddha never teaches that way. And there's nowhere in the suttas where he actually teaches that way. And this particular way of formulating the teaching only occurs in one other sutta. And in that one other sutta, it's taught not by the Buddha, but by some unnamed monks after the Buddha's death. So that's curious, isn't it? Right? So Asaji is saying, oh, this is what the Buddha normally says, but it's not what he normally says at all. Wonder why that might be. Anyone got any ideas?
Misrepresentation?
Do you mean like deliberate misrepresentation or accidental, perhaps? I mean, it could be just textual loss, right? It's easy enough. You know, you're just sitting there in the temple, been reciting all night, and you just skip over a bit. I did it just today, right? I skipped over the Namo Tassara at the beginning. I don't know if you noticed.
Yeah,
I did. You see? Very easy to do, right? Yeah? So normally what you do is, of course, you have like a group. You have a sanghiti, where everyone chants together. And that's why if somebody messes up, somebody else will, hey, come on, and I get it. So you sort of have that way of kind of correcting each other. So this problem has, of course, been noticed by a number of scholars. And I find that the responses to them are interesting. I won't go into too much detail, but Bhikkhu Bodhi comments on it. He basically quotes from the commentary. Now, the commentary says something like that Asaji omitted dukkha because he wanted to avoid saying something that might like upset Satchika and give him a way of refuting the Buddha's teachings. Seems a bit weird, doesn't it? Doesn't seem hugely plausible. But Bhikkhu Bodhi just sort of says that. He doesn't really endorse that or comment on it. This is in his translation of the Majjhima Nikaya. So Venerable Anālaya has a quite extensive discussion on this, and he points out, I think quite reasonably, that this doesn't seem to be a very plausible or convincing explanation by the commentary. He points out that there are two Chinese parallels to this sutta, both of which have a more extended passage which does in fact include dukkha. Okay? Nonetheless, in his discussion, he still concludes that the Pali text was most likely the original one, although without being very definitive about it. Okay? Now, I won't go too much into the kind of complexities of the comparative thing, but what's interesting to me is to notice that in each case, those two positions stem from the particular methodology that you use. Bhikkhu Bodhi is emphasizing, looking at what the commentaries say, and he just says, this is what the commentary says. Yeah? And Alio looks at what the Chinese comparative studies say, and they say, well, this is what the Chinese comparative studies say. So a lot of the times, I just felt like it was interesting to point this out, because, you know, people sometimes approach me and they say, you know, so-and-so says this and so-and-so says that. And I'm supposed to kind of deem which one is correct or something like that, right? But to me, this is not very interesting, right? The fact that people say different things is not very interesting. What's interesting is to understand why they say those things, right? How did they come to that conclusion? And why does it matter to them? And so when I was kind of looking at them, neither of these approaches were particularly satisfactory. Now, one of the approaches that I tried to bring to the study of the suttas is a study of narrative form. And this also is from my background. I have a background in literature and literary studies. And so one of the things I like to look at is like how is like the overall flow, the ebb and flow of ideas. Now, I mentioned that this particular passage is found only in one other place. It's a sutta which was given to Channa, the Buddha's former charioteer, after the Buddha passed away. So some of you may recollect that Channa was kind of obstinate and a troublemaker in the Sangha. And the Buddha pronounced on his deathbed, he's got the Brahma Danda, the supreme punishment against Channa, right? I mean, it's mortifying, right? Imagine that, the Buddha's last words, he's about to die. Oh, yeah, give Channa the Brahma Danda. What? It would be absolutely mortifying. So Channa, when he found out about this, was just horrified and wanted to try to redeem himself. So he went to some of the monks, he said, teach me. And so they taught him this same teaching that we just heard. Form, feeling, perception, five aggregates are impermanent, five aggregates are not self. Channa's like, okay, I know that, but like it doesn't make any difference. So he goes to seek Ananda. He says, Ananda will be able to help me. And Ananda gives him the teaching which is elsewhere known as the Kacchayanagata Sutta, within which, notably, it includes the phrase, Dukkameva upajjamanam upajjati, dukkham nirujjamanam nirujjati. What arises is just suffering arising. What ceases is just suffering ceases. So not only does Ananda mention suffering, mention dukkha, he mentions one of the most quietly devastating statements on dukkha in the whole of the Pali Canon. What arises is just suffering arising. What ceases is just suffering ceasing. And on hearing that, then Channa was okay. He was redeemed. He saw the Dhamma and understood the Dhamma. So, what I noticed was that the Sajjika Sutta follows basically the same narrative pattern. We have an obstinate student who comes along who asks, first of all, a lesser teacher, gets taught about impermanence and not self, that fails, then goes and asks the greater teacher, who then emphasizes dukkha. And the Buddha later on doesn't just mention dukkha, but he puts a special passage in emphasizing dukkha, which we'll come to later. And then that's effective, that actually succeeds in, he can understand that teaching. It's the same narrative pattern in both cases. So I think the point here is that you have to talk about dukkha. You can't leave it out. Yeah, I think this is a kind of the narrative subtext. And Asaji, of course, Asaji was a great monk, but he wasn't a renowned teacher, right? And so maybe he just taught in brief or taught something, but you know, we can't interpret too much about why he taught in that particular way. But I think that pattern is the same. If you leave out dukkha, you're leaving out an important part of the Dhamma. So anyway, that's my interpretation of that passage. All right. Moving along. Dukkha, not self. Okay, oh, the other interesting thing. Okay, go on. Blah, blah, blah. So he goes to the Buddha. He's going to drag him around. Fine. Then he goes to see the Buddha in the Great Wood. A few weeks ago, if you recall, we looked at the Mulapariyaya Sutta where the Buddha was also kind of accosted in the Great Wood. There was another Great Wood, though. Kamalawatu. Now, okay, so Then Satchika asks him, how does the ascetic Gotama guide his disciples and on what topics does instruction to his disciples generally proceed? And the Buddha responds with that same argument. So, in other words, he responds by just talking about impermanence and not self and says, this is how I guide my disciples, this is how instruction to my disciples generally proceeds. Now, obviously that's problematic. If my interpretation is correct, then why is the Buddha reinforcing Asaji's incomplete statement there? Look, I'm not really sure, and I don't have a good answer to that. Maybe that was just the text was standardized, because it was kind of the normal thing that the Buddha would do, would be to endorse the statements of his disciples. But regardless, it still remains the case that it simply isn't how his instructions to his disciples generally proceeds. Anyway, let's move along to the next bit. A simile strikes me, Master Gotama. Then speak as you feel inspired, said the Buddha. And Satchika said, oh, sorry, I should go back just one point which I omitted earlier. I mentioned Satchika is being addressed by both Asaji and the Buddha as Agivesana. So this is a Brahmanical clan name, and it's used as a term of address in the same way that Gotama, which is also a Brahmanical clan name, is used to address the Buddha. And this is probably because of the custom at the time that when one of the leading families was anointed in a kingship position, that they would be named after the clan of the Purohita, the family priest. And so this is why the Lichavis are referred to as Agivesana, and as are the Mullins, I think. The Mullins are Vasettas, I think. And the Sakyans are referred to as Gotama. So this is why we find these Khatiya clans named after Brahmanical priestly lineages. Anyway, moving along. Satchika says, now, a simile strikes me. All the plants and seeds that achieve growth, increase, and maturity do so depending on the earth and grounded upon the earth. All the hard work that gets done depends on the earth and is grounded on the earth. In the same way, an individual's self is form. Grounded on form, they create merit and wickedness. An individual's self is feeling, perception, choices, and consciousness. Grounded on consciousness, they create merit and wickedness. The Buddha responds, Agivesana, are you not saying this? Form is myself, feeling is myself, perception is myself, choices are myself, consciousness is myself. Indeed, Master Gotama, that is what I am saying, and this big crowd agrees with me. What is this big crowd to do with you? Please just unpack your own statement. Then, Master Gotama, what I am saying is this: form is myself, feeling is myself, perception is myself, choices are myself, consciousness is myself. All right, so nice. Okay, so Satchika is giving us a clear answer. This is what he believes, this is his belief, and so on. And we can see that obviously this is different from what the Buddha believes. So that's good, we've got some clarity there. A few interesting details about this. Now, one interesting detail is that he's describing his own doctrine in terms of the five aggregates. Right? Normally we think of the five aggregates as a Buddhist teaching, but this kind of suggests maybe it isn't, actually. Maybe it's not the teaching of the five aggregates as such that's a Buddhist teaching, but the way that the five aggregates are interpreted that's a Buddhist teaching. Yeah? The idea that these aggregates are the self is something that we find frequently in other places. Consider, for example, the Brahmajala Sutta, DN1, where there are many different views on self, which are described, for example, that myself is rupi. Myself is possessed of form. That's the first aggregate. Myself experiences exclusively pleasant feelings. Yeah, this is the faith. I think myself has unified perception. This is sanya, and so on. So perhaps the five aggregates were kind of a way of classifying theories of the self. All right? A way of classifying theories of the self. Now, we don't really find the five aggregates as such in any pre-Buddhist texts. So the Buddhas, as far as we know, historically came up with it, but then it seems that it's assumed. I mean, even in the Dhammacakkappavattana Sutta, the first sermon, the same thing, right? The Buddha just mentions the five aggregates of suffering as if he assumes that everyone knows what he's talking about. So this actually, I think this is a subtle point, but I think it's a kind of interesting one because it gives a different perspective on the understanding of the five aggregates and not self than the one that we're normally told in modern Theravada Buddhism. So in modern Theravada Buddhism, it's often the analysis of not self and the khandhas is often presented in a reductive way. Okay, so the argument is that thing, that whole thing that you take to be the self, is nothing more than these five khandhas. You see, you think that this is a whole, but in fact it's a bunch of parts. Yeah, but this is not quite the argument that the Buddha makes, because Sajjaka actually thinks that each one of these parts is his self. And you could say this whole is just this bunch of parts, and Sajjaka could say, sure, each one of these parts is myself. So that reductive argument doesn't quite work. How the Buddha argued was to say, well, if you look closely at these different parts, you'll find that they don't have the characteristics of a self. They are not happy. They are not under our control, which is a point we're going to come back to in a minute. So I think this is a kind of interesting sort of detail to see how this teaching on the five aggregates stands in terms of the discussions at the time between Buddhists and non-Buddhists. It wasn't that some said it's the self and some said it's the five aggregates, but they all said, well, how do we interpret what these five aggregates are? Coming back to the similes that Sajjaka uses, plants and so on achieve growth, increase, and maturity depending on the earth and grounded on the earth. I mentioned before that Udalaka was one of his characteristics was to use naturalistic metaphors. He also had a very strong tendency, one of the most important parts of his philosophy was to show how the world of multiplicity emerges from singleness. Right, just as the earth will produce many different plants. When Odalika was asked in the Chandogya Upanishad who he worships as self, he answered he worships the earth, and the earth is said to be the ground, the pratishtha. So it's using the same language that we're finding here. And it's due to this worship that he enjoys food and offspring. So this is not like exactly the same as what Sajjaka is saying, right? And you know, maybe it's just a coincidence. I don't want to overstate it, but there certainly is a sort of similarity of ideas that's coming here, and we'll find more similarities later on. Now I want to come back to this idea of Sajjaka saying that the form is the self, feeling is the self, perception is the self, choices are the self, consciousness is the self. It seems like a lot of selves. Did Sajjaka, apart from inventing modern trolldom, did he also invent multiple personality disorder? Right? Was he walking along and, oh yes, my body is one self, my feel. I mean, it sometimes feels like that, right? You've got to admit, right? Your body's walking in one direction, your mind's going in another direction, your memory's in another direction. It kind of feels like you've got a bunch of different selves all doing their own thing. Well, maybe that's just me. So what's going on here? How can he, surely if a self is an irreducible essence of who you are, then how can there be these many different kinds of selves? Okay. Again, we can look back at how the Upanishads talk about things. And the Upanishads have two contrasting or complementary methodologies, the methodology of affirmation and the methodology of negation. Yajnavalkya typically used the methodology of negation. Neti, neti, not that, not that. And he would say, oh, you take this to be yourself, that's not yourself. Your belongings, this is not yourself. Your family is not yourself. Your children is not yourself. All the things that you hold dear, this is not yourself. But this is yourself. And so he would get rid of all of these things and leave with this. And this clearly is a precursor to the Buddha's methodology. But some people, and Udalaka among them, use a methodology of affirmation. This is yourself, and this is yourself, and this is yourself, and this is yourself. Right? These are all different aspects of the self in more and more and more subtle ways. So these are not, they sort of appear to be saying contradictory things, but they're not really seen in that tradition as being contradictory. On the one hand, you can say, well, this is not yourself in the sense that it's not really the truest form of yourself. Whereas the Udalika would tend to more affirm these things are the self moving towards that still that truest form of the self. So this is what this teaching of Satchika is leaning on. Right? He's seeing all of these different things as manifestations of the self. Sometimes they use the word sheaths of the self, the kosha of the self. So you have the kind of the form is on the outside, and then you draw out more and more and more subtle forms of the self from the rupa and so on until various kinds of feeling and things until eventually you get to consciousness, who is in the middle. So this is, I think, what's going on with Satchika and his ideas. Now, let's continue. The Buddha goes on, well, Agivesana, I'll ask you in return, you can answer as you like. Consider an anointed aristocratic king such as Pasenadi of Kosala or Jatasattu of Magadha, son of the princess of Videha. Would they have the power in their own realm to execute those who have incurred execution, fine those who have incurred fines, or banish those who have incurred banishment? Satchika says, an anointed king would have such a power, Master Gotama. Even federations such as the Vajjis and Mallas have such power in their own realm. So, of course, an anointed king such as Pasenadi or Jatasattu would wield such power as is their right. Okay, so you notice how sort of Satchika's way of phrasing, he's very characterful, right? Like everything that he says has this kind of distinctive kind of character, and he's sort of going over the top all the time. The Buddha doesn't really say that these kings are right to exercise this power. And I think it's important to notice this for students in the Pali class. This is using a future passive participle, which can be translated as they execute those who deserve execution. Okay, so this is one possible translation there. But that would imply that the Buddha's endorsing capital punishment, right? Which he didn't elsewhere, and obviously contradicts the first precept. So the future passive participle, they execute those to be executed, implies here that they execute those who have been found guilty and legally have incurred that crime of execution, but he's not endorsing it, he's merely giving that example. Whereas Satchika, of course, does endorse it, and specifically goes out of his way to say that it is their right, which, again, well, one of the reasons for thinking that he's not a Jain, because that's definitely not a Jain position. Notice also Satchika's kind of rhetorical canniness here, right? He's sitting there in the midst of 500 lichavis, right? The Buddha's talking about these other kings, and he says, oh yeah, even these lichavis would have this power as well, right? Yeah, he's clever. Yeah, he's a clever speaker. Anyway, moving along. Now, what do you say, Agivesana? When you say form is myself, this form is myself, this is who I am, do you have power over that form to say, may my form be like this, may it not be like that? When he said this, Satchika kept silent. The Buddha asked the question a second time, but Satchika still kept silent. So the Buddha said to Satchika, answer now, Agivesana. Now is not the time for silence. If someone fails to answer a legitimate question when asked three times by the Buddha, their head explodes into seven pieces there and then. Now at that time, the spirit Vajrapani, taking up a burning iron thunderbolt, blazing and glowing, stood in the sky above Satchika, thinking, if this Satchika doesn't answer when asked the third time, I'll blow his head into seven pieces there and there. And both the Buddha and Satchika could see him. Satchika was terrified, shocked and awestruck, looking to the Buddha for protection, shelter and refuge. He said, ask me, Master Gotama, I will answer. What do you think, Agivesana, when you say form is myself? Do you have power over that form to say, may my form be like this, may it not be like that? No, Master Gotama. Think about it, Agivesana. Think before answering. What you said before and what you said after don't match up. When you say feeling of myself, perception, choices, consciousness on myself, do you have the power to be able to say, may they be like this, may they be like that? No, Master Gotama. All right, so Now, as to the historical question about whether the Buddha really threatened him to have his head blown into seven pieces and whether there literally was a deity, Vajrapani, above them with a thunderbolt, I cannot say, okay? I wasn't there. If someone was there with their phone, they could have filmed it and they would know what happened, but I wasn't there, so I cannot comment. But interesting detail here, or one of the interesting details here, is that the question is about the inner controller. May my form be like this, may my form be not like that. The inner controller. Now, if you read any of the Hindu non-dual literature, you'll find that this antaryami, this inner controller, is referred to quite often. It's a kind of a basic thing that is an attribute of the self. Right? So our self is the inner controller that manages everything that's happening out there in the world. And you find this sort of referenced again and again and again. Curiously enough, though, in the Upanishads themselves, it only appears in one passage, one chapter. That chapter is a chapter between a conversation between Yajnavalkya and, you guessed it, Uddalaka. So this is the Uddalaka raises this question of the inner controller. And another curious detail. Many of you who hear that passage, you're probably familiar with it because it appears very prominently in the Buddha's second discourse, the Anattalakkhana Sutta, where he asks that same question, can form be controlled? Can you wish it be like this and wish it be like that? And so this is a passage that when you hear it, you sort of think, oh, this is a familiar teaching by the Buddha. And it became one that's very influential in modern Buddhism. In fact, The very first teaching on not self that I ever received was when I was at a monastery in northern Thailand, in Chiang Mai, Wat Rampong. They gave us very little teachings, and I still remember when he taught us just a couple of 5 minutes of teachings. We got through the whole retreat, really. But one of the things he mentioned, anicca, dukkha, anatta, and when he mentioned anatta, he said, can't control. Right? That's what not self means, can't control. Very good, simple definition of anatta, because it's very practical, right? It makes you look at what's happening in your experience, and you realize that all this experience is out of your control without getting too caught up in all of the metaphysics of it and so on.
Excuse me, yeah. Who's he?
Oh, he was, I was trying to remember that when I was talking, his name was, he was the leading lay teacher who was helping to manage the retreats for the English-speaking students on that retreat. Yes, and his name was, I met him again years later in Bodh Gaya, actually. His name was, it'll come to me soon. Yeah, but that's who gave us that short teaching. Yeah. Apart from that, we would have like meditation guidance, but we wouldn't have actual teachings. That's going to bug me now. All right, so can't control. Of course, the idea that yourself you can't control, we find in a number of places in the suttas, and it's not just in this place. But that particular phrasing of it is only here and in the Anattalakkhana Sutta, only those two places. Just like the teaching on the antaryami actually seems like it's quite a common teaching in non-dual or Hinduism teachings, but actually is only found in that one passage in the Upanishad. All right. Yajnavalkya explains the inner controller as being the self who lives in the midst of all things, unknown but knowing and controlling all from within. So this is one of the details which suggests a kind of connection between these two passages, between the teachings of Uddalaka and this sutta. All right, I'm going to go down a little bit further. So the Buddha then goes on, having taught about the not controlling, he then continues, as does the Anattalakkhana Sutta, is form permanent or impermanent? Impermanent, but if it's impermanent, is it suffering or happiness? Suffering, but if it's impermanent, suffering and perishable, is it fit to be regarded thus? This is mine, I am this is myself. And so thus introducing the much more common teaching on not self that's found in many suttas. Suffering is now reintroduced, all right? So the Buddha clearly wasn't avoiding that topic. But also notice how we introduce the very famous phrase, this is mine, I am this is myself. Eso hamasmi, etam mama eso hamasmi eto me atati. which is constantly found in the Pali Canon as a statement of belief in a self, and then the opposite for the belief in not self. Now, that particular phrase, the eso hamasmi in particular, is almost a direct quote from Udalaka. So Udalaka said very famously, tad tuang asi, which means thou art, usually translated as thou art that. It's exactly the same words, in fact, just in second person rather than first person. Eso hamasmi, I am that, as opposed to you are that. So the Buddha in this same passage, which we've already seen, has a number of similarities with Udalaka's teaching, is actually introducing this phrase, which is pretty much a direct quote. The whole passage, or at least a larger passage there from Udalaka, sarvang tat satyang sa atma tad tvamasi, which translates as, all that is the truth, that is the self, you are that. So I do believe that the Buddha adopted or paraphrased that teaching of Udalaka when he said, etam mama eso hamasmi eso me atati. And there are a number of similar phrases also attributed to Udalaka. Okay, so then the Buddha's Agivesana is interrogated by the Buddha on Nicca and Dukkha Anatta. Then at the end of that, the Buddha then says, what do you think, Agivesana? Consider someone who clings, holds, and attaches to suffering, regarding it thus. This is mine, I am this, this is myself. Would such a person be able to completely understand suffering themselves or live having wiped out suffering? How could they? No, Master Gotama. What do you think, Agivesana? This being so, aren't you someone who clings, holds, and attaches to suffering, regarding it thus? This is mine, I am this, this is myself. How could I not? Yes, Master Gotama. So notice again here that this passage is what I was referring to earlier when I'm saying the Buddha actually gives a special emphasis on suffering. Actually, this passage is kind of unusual, and the Buddha's kind of like a bit merciless here. I mean, he's hammering it home to poor old Satchaka. You know, he's already kind of got the point, and he's driving it home here. So the Buddha says, in the same way, when pursued, pressed, and grilled by me on your own doctrine, you turn out to be void, hollow, and mistaken. But it was you who stated before the assembly of Vaisali, I don't see any ascetic or Brahmin who would not shake, rock, and tremble, sweating from the armpits, were I to take them on in debate. Even an insentient post would tremble were I to take it on in debate. But now sweat is pouring from your forehead. It's soaked through your robe and drips on the ground, while I have no sweat on my body. And so the Buddha revealed his golden body to the assembly. Okay? All right? So, not embarrassed, okay? And then when this was said, Satchaka sat silent, dismayed, shoulders drooping, downcast, depressed, with nothing to say. Now, with knowing this, Alichavi Dumukha said to the Buddha, a simile strikes me, blessed one. Then speak as you feel inspired. So suppose, we don't know anything about Dumukha, except his name means sad face. Suppose there was a lotus pond not far from a town or village and a crab lived there. Several boys or girls would leave the town or village, go to the pond where they'd pull out the crab and put it on dry land. Whenever the crab extended a claw, those boys or girls would snap, crack, and break it off with a stick or stone. I like the fact that it says boys or girls would crack and snap the crab's claws off, that we have equal opportunity for cruelty among children. I think this is good. Sometimes we think that boys are cruel, but girls have the opportunity to be just as cruel and nasty, so I think that's good. Not that they should, obviously, but anyway, when all that crab's claws had been snapped, cracked, and broken off, it wouldn't be able to return down into that lotus pond in the same way. So the Buddha has snapped, cracked, and broken off all of Satchaka's twists, ducks, and dodges. Now he can't get near the Buddha again, looking for a debate. But Satchaka said to him, hold on, Dumukha, hold on. I wasn't talking with you. I was talking with Master Gotama. And Master Gotama, leave that statement I made aside, as did various other Samanas and Brahmanas. It was just like a bit of nonsense. Okay? So this is like the lol joke excuse. And then he goes on, how do you define a disciple of Master Gotama who follows instructions? I'm going to abbreviate here because we've been going on a little bit long. How do you define a disciple of Master Gotama who follows instructions? And the Buddha defines that as somebody who sees the five aggregates as this is not mine, I'm not this, this is myself. And then how do you define a one who's a perfected one, an arahant? It's someone who sees the five aggregates as this is not mine, this I am not this, this is not myself, and with right understanding they're freed by not grasping. A mendicant whose mind is freed like this has three unsurpassable qualities: unsurpassable seeing, unsurpassable practice, and unsurpassable freedom, and they honor, respect, esteem, they venerate only the realized one. And Satchika said, Master Gotama, it was rude and impudent of me to imagine I could attack you in debate. For a person might find safety after attacking a rutting elephant, but not after attacking Master Gotama. A person might find safety after attacking a blazing mass of fire, but not after attacking Master Gotama. They might find safety after attacking a poisonous viper, but not after attacking Master Gotama. He certainly has a way with words, right? He's no problem with vivid and memorable language. It was rude and impudent of me to imagine I could attack you in debate. Would Master Gotama, together with the mendicant Sangha, please accept tomorrow's meal from me? The Buddha consented with silence. Then, knowing that the Buddha had consented, Satchika addressed the Lichavis and invited them to come for the meal offering the next day. Prepared the meal, offered it. The Buddha went along with the Sangha. They served him. Satchika took a seat to one side, said to the Buddha, Master Gotama, may the merit and the flourishing of merit in this gift be for the happiness of the donors. Agivesana, whatever comes from a recipient of religious donations such as yourself, who is not free from greed, hatred, and delusion, will accrue to the donors. That is to say, what the Lichavis gave to you. But whatever will accrue to giving a recipient to someone such as myself, who is free from greed, hatred, and delusion, will accrue to you. According to one of the Chinese parallels, that statement was actually said after he returned to the monastery on the inquiry by the monks, not actually said to Agivesana. Anyway, so this is the Chula Satchika Sutta. So, look, I must admit, I have a lot of sympathy for Satchika. I think he was, he's smart. He's got confidence, you know, a lot of good qualities, good way with language. But he's let down by just not being really very sincere, you know, and engaging in this kind of bad faith argumentation. You know, and this is what I think sometimes people do, and sometimes this is why it does remind me a lot of internet trolls, where you, because you've only really engaged people in this kind of bad faith way, you kind of assume that that's what everybody else is doing. You know, everybody else is just trying to score points and win an argument. So that's actually what debate is about. Yeah? And so when we see this, when we see how the Buddha responded, then it gives us a really good example of how this can be done. Now, in this particular case, he was there. You know, it's different. Like if you're dealing with a troll online, it's difficult because they're not there, you know, and because, you know, you know in person, you know more about them. You know, you can see their body language, maybe you know some of their background. You know, there's a much richer discussion. As dealing with trolls online, it's harder, right? It's hard to actually have that kind of conversation. It's also rare to find someone who's a troll who will actually admit that they're wrong, whereas Satchika did. So this actually is a really good quality. And Satchika was very happy to admit that he was mistaken. And so, you know, good on him for that. And so according to the tradition, you know, at a later time he was able to get enlightened, not maybe in this lifetime, but according to tradition he was at least put on the path by that teaching. So this is the Chula Satchika Sutta of Majjhima Nikaya number 35. And I hope that's been reasonably entertaining and informative. And also Majjhima 36, check it out, is also the follow-up, the sequel. You know, when you have a sutta that's so successful like that, you just got to put out another one. To... probably not. I'll probably have another one for next week. Yeah, I didn't have so much to say about the Mahasachika. Sutta. Yeah. Not it's not everyone like you know, it's not every sutta that I really feel like I have a lot to add to, you know, a lot of them but from time to time you look at it and you think, hey, that's interesting. So any questions? Yeah.
It's probably more to do with the language. English is not my first language. So it's a common expression, this is not me, this is not mine, this is not myself.
Yeah.
I was confused what the last one is pointing to. So this is not me, it's like my identity.
Okay.
It's not mine, it's like
right.
Come.
Yep. Great question. So the question was, in those three statements, this is not mine, this is not I am, this is not myself, this is not mine refers to like feeling of like ownership, that things belong to you. So this works through craving, right? I'm gonna have something. The second one, I am this, right? This works through conceit, through a sense of identity, right? So this is what I am. Yeah? The last one, this is myself, this works through views. Right? So this myself is a theory about this is what myself is. So it's identifying like my like form is myself rather than conceit, which is a more basic level of identity. So for example, think about how say a dog would think about it, right? So a dog is like, don't hurt me, you know? And so it responds on level of identity, but it doesn't sit there in its kennel musing about whether Rupa is his true form or Vedana is his true form. I mean, hopefully. I mean, it'd be pretty distressing if dogs were doing that and other animals, but presumably they're not sort of thinking at that level of abstraction. So this is that kind of, so the last one is views. So those three is craving, conceit, and views. Yeah. Does that make sense?
Yes.
Is there a source for the explanation?
Maybe. Maybe. I'm sweating now. I was asked about the source of the explanation. I would have to think about that. I'm not really quite sure. Yeah.
That's okay.
Yeah, I don't know. Maybe I just made it up.
It feels like it kind of sort of maps onto three kinds of tanha. So you have essential.
Okay. Maybe, yeah. I mean, a lot of these groups of three do kind of map onto each other, yeah. I didn't really sort of get into it in there, but this is actually another one of Uddalika's things. One of Uddalika's things was everything was about groups of three. Yeah, his whole kind of philosophy was about groups of three. It started out with, being, producing fire, producing water. And this whole kind of things, if colours and taste and everything is like correlated.
So what was the connection between Satchika and Udalika again,
Bhante? Well, uncertain really. So there are a number of passages in there that refer to specific ideas which are found in Udalika's teachings, specifically the one on the inner controller. And the one on the Eso Hamasmi, which is a quote from originated by Udalika. So in addition to that, there's also some other things that are more like sort of general narrative similarities and thematic similarities in how Satchika was thinking and the similes that he's using. So whether that's enough to establish that there's a really genuine historical connection between the two, I'm not entirely sure. I think there probably is. But if you think if it, maybe that's too tenuous and maybe that's not. Yeah, but that's I mean, one of the things that I find doing this work is that sometimes you have to you kind of accumulate bits of things that themselves appear irrelevant, but then after a while, then you find that pattern. You know, like it was like say the inner controller thing. Like I sort of noted that this is the inner controller. It's the Antaryami. And then it was only much later that I realized, oh yeah, this is actually Udalika who introduces this idea. So anyway. Go on, yeah?
Yeah. I was listening to some talks by John Brown, state, sort of inclined to translate consciousness into plurals, consciousnesses.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think there is a base for that? Do you agree to that approach, or what do you think about that? So obviously you don't do that.
I mean, it's usually expressed in a singular form, but it is plural, right? There's eye consciousness, ear consciousness, and so on. So there isn't like a singular consciousness. I mean, this is one of the defining differences between the suttas, between the Buddha's teachings and the Upanishads, right? The Upanishads, everything is reduced to consciousness, whereas in the suttas, they have multiple different forms of consciousness. Yeah. Yep.
Can we also, if I take, can we take away anything from the sutta in terms of how we deal with trolls?
With trolls? How we can deal with trolls. Okay, well, here's one thing we can deal, and I already mentioned this in passing, but if a troll is susceptible to correct themselves, then they may be worth continuing to talk to them. But if they continue to avoid the topic and won't admit mistakes, even when they're obviously making a mistake, then there's not really any point. Yeah. It's one of the easiest things to do with when dealing with trolls. You know, so what I do is just to see if someone's not even able to admit a basic mistake, then not really any point in, yeah. Block and move on. Block and move on. Block and move on. I must say, though, that Elon Musk has done a great service in the dealing with trolls, because he made if you use Twitter, then he made the blue checks payable. When all the trolls bought blue checks, and now you can just block all the blue checks. It's great. They just go away. Yeah, it's supposed to be this, like the opposite of what he wanted. Anyway, there's a few comments here in the chat, and I'll just quickly run through those. So Letty asked whether the self is considered fractal. Yeah, so it's an interesting idea, right? So the idea of a fractal self is related to that idea of that method of affirmation. This is a self, this is the self, this is the self. And the sort of you go into it, and the deeper and deeper you still find that it still expresses the self in a different way. So I think, yeah, there's something definitely to that idea. And, you know, one of the things, in fact, like if you consider fractals, okay, so one of the ideas of one of the ways that fractals are then presented is through things like the Mandelbrot set and so on. So you have like this image, and then you sort of, as you zoom into it, it sort of keeps revealing itself, but it keeps revealing itself at the same level of resolution. So the further you go into it, it doesn't pixelate. You just keep going as long as you like. It's an infinitely recurring pattern. And Udalika did kind of use that kind of idea. One of Udalika's most famous similes was when he was teaching his student, or his son really, Sweta Ketu, about the nature of the self. And he said, here's a seed, you know, is this seed yourself? He said, okay, you break open the seed and you see the flesh of the seed, and then you break open the flesh and you see the kernel of the seed, and you break open the kernel of the seed, and what do you see in there? He said, well, I don't see anything. He said, well, that's yourself. Yeah? So again, this kind of idea of like affirmation, but it's actually quite close to the idea of not-self, right? So this is why these things were laying the groundwork for the Buddha's teachings. I just mentioned that in relation to the question you asked earlier about why do you see the connection between Satchika and Udalika, one of the other things, that there's also a couple of other things that come up in the next sutta, in the Majjhima 36, also, which kind of perhaps reinforce that pattern as well. So, yeah.
More questions?
Let's just go with the folks online, see how long we got. So somebody from Santi, obviously looking for a career change, they ask, how do you get the gig of smiting people on behalf of the Buddha? I think that the smiter is Indra, he's like a war god. And so you have to first of all be a war god and go around smiting people and get really good at it, and then you have to get converted to Buddhism and like redeem yourself and make good karma from that. So that's like that's how you do that. Bhante, am I able to tell which sutta we're going to discuss the following week so we can get a print for the session? I would love to be able to do that, but that would require this little thing that we know as organization. It seems unlikely. Because really, this really just comes out of the work that I'm doing during the week, and I don't really know what I'm going to find out. So it's not like I'm saying I'm going to do this sutra. It's like, actually, I just discover something during the week, so that's why I come and talk about it. So it is a bit chaotic like that. I apologize. Okay, so Eddie asks, if there is no self, who is actually there aware to do things like meditation or to learn Dhamma? Oh, my goodness, Eddie. Oh my God, you're right, we have to give up Buddhism now. Obviously. Okay, so again, very briefly to discuss a very subtle matter, very briefly. So the Buddha was, you're still there, Eddie, so don't worry about it, okay? You're still there, but you're just impermanent and conditioned and changing. So there's no like underlying eternal essence of who you are. But who you are is like this sort of conventional reality, which is made up of all of these different things. In the same way that something like, say, a country is land, but it's also laws and it's people and it's customs and all of those kinds of things. So there's no kind of irreducible, single, eternal entity, which is a land or a country. So this is what the Buddha was talking about when he's talking about not self. Bharat asks, here the Buddha is refuting the self that is meant in an absolute sense, like an unchanging entity such as a soul. Yes, thanks, Bharat, that's for that explanation. So Santi then asks, continuing along their career change line, asks, is it good karma to smite people on behalf of the Buddha? Look, I'm gonna make a call on this and say no. Generally speaking, heads are best left where they are. Obviously there's a few moments there that kind of feel a bit like some kind of narrative embellishment, right? I mean, was there really that happening? I don't know, it feels a bit fanciful, you know, did the Buddha really strip down in front of everyone just to prove a point that he wasn't sweating? I don't know, it doesn't feel that much like something the Buddha would do, but who knows, right? I don't want to make any assumptions about these things. But it does kind of feel to me like there's been some kind of not a huge amount, but some kind of narrative glossing up, maybe a few effects added in post, as it were, to sort of jazz it up a bit. On the other hand, you know, one of the things that's really, I think, really comes across strongly in that sutta is the personality of Sacchaka. And, you know, he comes across very much as a real person. And with all of his, you know, good and bad qualities. So, yeah, that's one of the things that makes it such a lively and interesting sutta. Aya?
Sorry, this is a question which is slightly related.
Okay.
In the UK, they have Speaker's Corner.
Yeah.
I'm vaguely aware we have something here, but it's not very well frequented. Do you know the concept like that?
Speaker's Corner?
Yeah.
Like you stand on it in like a soapbox and you just... Pontificate. Yeah.
Do you think it's a good idea?
I don't know, that sounds entertaining. Could be worse,
would
right?
Would you do it if we asked you to?
Would I do it? No. Sounds a bit like a setup, yeah.
Thank you for
No worries. Okay, very good. So, we should wrap up there. Been a little bit longer than usual tonight, so hopefully not too long. Thanks, everybody, for your attention.